costs for them. At that time, however, reimbursement from insurance companies was much better than it is today, and our profit margin made charitable care possible and even fun. Today, to a large extent, insurance companies call the shots on what they want to pay, to whom, and when. Consequently, even busy doctors operate with a very slim profit margin and find it much more difficult to offer care to the poor and pay for it out of their profit. I speak from personal experience because over the last many years, I have had to cut my staff significantly due to low insurance company reimbursements. That cut in staff also means a cut in services that we can offer. Our desire to help more people is at odds with our ability to do so due to lack of funding. Although I could donate my services, I cannot volunteer the services of my operating room staff or other ancillary personnel to help care for a patient who can't afford their own medical care. This is an ideal place for the intervention of government regulators who, with the help of medical professionals, could establish fair and consistent remuneration throughout the country. To accomplish this, essentially, all of the insurance companies would have to become non-profit service organizations with standardized, regulated profit margins. I should quickly add that this is not the paradigm that I see for all businesses. And in fact, this is uniquely appropriate for the health insurance industry, which deals with people's lives and quality of existence. These things should not be treated like commodities or industrial products. That may sound radical, but is it as radical as allowing a company to increase its profits by denying care to sick individuals? In the long run, this would also be good for the insurance companies, who could then concentrate on providing good service to their customers, rather than focusing on undercutting their competitor and increasing their profit margin. It would also drastically decrease the number of people each insurance company would have to hire, all of whom have to be paid out of the healthcare dollar. Thus, insurance premiums would decline, making health insurance more affordable for everyone. A health stamp program? But what about those who have no healthcare insurance? How are we supposed to care for them when we are already stretched to our financial limits? Interestingly enough, there aren't, in fact, 52 million people without healthcare insurance in this country. All they have to do is go to the emergency room where, by law, they must be taken care of if they truly have an emergency. The problem is, emergency care costs 5 times as much as it would if they were getting regular preventive care in a clinic. And unfortunately, the rest of us pay for it. The logical question we should ask then is, how do we get those same people to go to the clinic instead? First of all, we must recognize that we are already paying for their care at a much higher rate when they show up in the emergency room. If we can get them to go to the clinic, however, we will still be paying for their health care, but at a much lower rate. We might do well to look at another government program that has been around for decades and saved millions of people from chronic hunger. The food stamp program allocates money for food in an electronic account at the beginning of each month. People learn very quickly not to go out the first 5 days and buy porterhouse steak, leaving them with nothing to spend on food for the rest of the month. They learn to look for bargains and other ways to stretch their allocation for the entire month. If we had electronic medical accounts for the indigent in this country, they too would have the incentive to save money when medical problems arose. For example, if Mr. Smith has a diabetic foot ulcer and goes to the emergency room, he will be adequately patched up and sent out. But if he goes to the clinic, not only will he be paying much less, but he will be patched up and an attempt will be made to get his diabetes under control, hopefully preventing a trip back in 3 weeks with another diabetic complication. By looking at preventive care and wellness, we as a society will begin to save enormous amounts of money while achieving a significantly higher level of health. This is especially important as our population continues to age, since aging is accompanied by a slew of medical problems that can be avoided or reduced if detected early. Also, I am very fond of saying that if everyone ate 3 well-balanced meals each day, drank 8 glasses of water or water-equivalent substances, regularly got a full night's sleep, regularly exercised, and did not smoke or put harmful substances into their bodies, we in the medical profession would become very bored. Unfortunately, given the state of health in our nation, I don't think we have to worry about that anytime soon. Bringing down the cost of healthcare. Often when people are looking for a new job, they're very interested in the healthcare benefits that are offered. Because healthcare insurance has become so expensive, most people are not able to afford it on their own, and therefore need to be sure that their employer includes this as a benefit. But why is healthcare insurance so expensive? Much of the expense is due to coverage of catastrophic medical events. There was a time when premature babies or babies with significant birth defects simply died, which cost the insurance company very little. Now, however, thanks to developments in medical technology, we're able to put such babies in incubators and treat them, usually saving their lives. But then we hand the insurance company a bill for $1 million. We can take an 85-year-old woman with diabetes, hypertension, and thyroid disease who develops a brain tumor or cardiac condition and successfully treat her, and then give the insurance company a bill for a few a few hundred thousand dollars. This kind of scenario, repeated on a regular basis, drove insurance companies to drastically increase their premiums, resulting in the situation we have today. I certainly applaud all the medical advances that have lengthened all of our lives while giving us quality of life, but there must be a logical solution to the ever-rising cost of insurance premiums. One solution would be to remove from the insurance companies the responsibility for catastrophic healthcare coverage, making it a government responsibility. I can hear someone shouting now that the government can never do anything correctly, but I beg to differ. It is because of a government program known as FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Agency, that most of us are able to afford our homeowners insurance. If there were no FEMA, Allstate, State Farm, Nationwide, and all the other homeowner insurance companies would be telling us that they had to drastically increase premiums because there might be an earthquake, tornado, hurricane, tsunami, or other natural disaster that would otherwise drain their coffers. Homeowners insurance would be so expensive that you would have to ask your employer to cover it. Clearly, if the healthcare insurance companies did not have to cover catastrophic healthcare, it would be relatively easy by analyzing actuarial tables to determine how much money they are likely to be liable for each year, which of course would determine how much money they had to take in. With this information at our disposal, health insurance companies could be regulated just as utilities are regulated. If we did not regulate utilities, few people would be able to afford their water or electricity. The next question, of course, is how will the government pay for catastrophic health care? This is open for debate, but I think it would be quite reasonable to allow insurance companies a 15% annual profit, 5% of which would go to the government's National Catastrophic Healthcare Fund. Since the government would now have the responsibility of paying for catastrophic healthcare, we as a society would be forced to examine the policies that have led to a situation in which 40 to 50% of all healthcare dollars are spent during the last 6 months of a person's life. We put dying people in intensive care units while testing, poking, and prodding them until they render up their last breath. Unlike most other countries of the world, many of us do not seem to acknowledge that death is not optional. It is perfectly reasonable to send terminal patients to hospice, where compassionate and comfortable care can be rendered until death takes place. Much of the excessive care that currently occurs when a patient is terminal is given by healthcare providers who fear lawsuits if they fail to provide that care. Others are simply procedure-oriented, recognizing that they will be paid whether the patient survives or not. Fortunately, these individuals are relatively rare in the medical profession. Again, I can hear some people screaming after reading this that I'm advocating for death panels. Some people like to put forth terms like this because they stir up emotional responses rather than encouraging people to engage in rational dialogue aimed at resolving issues. Obviously, as our population ages and as our medical technology becomes more sophisticated and expensive, the potential for bankrupting our society with medical cost skyrockets. We are facing a time when we have to be pragmatic, while at the same time exercising compassion. One day, we will be able to keep the average person alive for 150 or even 200 years due to medical advances, and we will then be faced with the question, should we use our advanced knowledge in a way that will rapidly overpopulate the world? The emotional answer would be, yes, of course, we should use our knowledge to extend every life, and we can worry about the consequences later. A more rational response would include examining the effect on the entire population of such action and perhaps advocating a more measured course of action. I remember a case of a prominent individual who had been in an automobile accident and was rendered a C1 quadriplegic, which means not only was he paralyzed from the neck down, but he could not breathe without assistance. We could have made the decision to keep him alive at all cost, but through a unique system of communication that we were able to work out with him, he indicated that he wanted to die. After much debate, We yielded to his wishes and withdrew ventilatory support. In the long run, I think our course of action was both compassionate and pragmatic. If we integrate compassion and logic into our decision-making processes, I am convinced that we will deal with newly emerging ethical dilemmas appropriately. When I was a member of the President's Council on Bioethics, discussions on matters such as these were very complex, but they need to be engaged in now to avoid a reactive situation in the future. I believe age should not be the determining factor of the level of care that should be given. Rather, we should consider a person's potential for quality long-term survival. Many people in their 80s and 90s are very productive members of society, and they certainly should not be denied insurance coverage for certain procedures simply because of age alone. Approaching these problems with logic rather than with emotion leading us will yield the right answers, but it will require in-depth discussions by wise people. As the Bible says, in the multitude of counselors there is safety. Proverbs 11:14. When a society faces major changes, such as drastically increased life expectancy, its people should examine the effects of such a change and make logical, appropriate adjustments. We should thoroughly examine the effects of our aging society on our way of life and devise compassionate methods of easing the burden of aging, both on the individual and the family. Producing and protecting our healthcare dollars. The only thing that prevents us from having the most fabulous healthcare packages imaginable for every citizen of the United States is lack of money, some may say. How can we get more money to invest in healthcare? Perhaps, as some have suggested, we can simply tax the rich since they have plenty and should be willing to share with everyone. Another idea, which now perhaps seems radical, but once was a pillar of the American way, is to grow the economy, providing a lift for every segment of society. Consider the following story to illustrate. There were once two brothers, each of whom got married, had children, and moved to separate deserted islands. Their diet consisted solely of trees, and they could eat every part of the tree, including the roots, bark, branches, and leaves. The family of one of the brothers always monitored the new growth of trees and anxiously devoured every tender sapling, which, of course, never allowed them to grow into mature trees. Eventually, that family ate every sapling on the island and died of starvation. The other family was very disciplined, and while they ate some of the trees, allowed most of the saplings to grow into mature trees, providing them with unlimited food forever. This is a simple story, but it is easy to see how it applies to a government that continues to tax the rich until there are no more rich, and then begins to tax everyone else without ever curbing its growth or its appetite for money. Eventually, it destroys itself. A much wiser government in need of money would examine the methods used by the rich to obtain their wealth, and would try to create an economic environment that would cultivate even more rich people, all of whom would pay their fair share of taxes, vastly increasing the government's coffers. In other words, the more productive people you have in your society, the bigger your tax base. And if those people are paying their proportionate share based on income, it will be a big win for the government. All we have to do is study our nation's own history of entrepreneurial innovation to understand what needs to be done to rev up our economy once again. Generating more money to go toward our nation's health care also requires protecting the money we have. And we lose tens of billions of dollars to Medicare and Medicaid fraud every year. This is something we have not been able to control, either because we don't care very much and view other issues as much more important, or because we are incompetent. Both of these problems we can fix, which gives me hope that we will not forever be robbed. If we are ever going to have adequate funding for health care and other major line items in our budget, however, we have to put an end to waste and fraud throughout the government. And we must create a friendly climate for economic growth. These are such basic common sense ideas, I have a hard time understanding why so many of our government officials totally lack insight on this. I have heard important people in Washington say that fraud, waste, and abuse are an integral part of our system of government and that there is really nothing to be done about it. I hope and pray that we have not fallen to accepting the very things our founding fathers so desperately wanted to avoid. We cannot capitulate to moral decay, and our history dictates that we should not give up this fight. It is extremely difficult to estimate how much money is wasted in the healthcare arena because doctors engage in defensive medicine to avoid lawsuits. During the healthcare debate prior to the passage of the bill in 2010, many opponents of tort reform said that adding that to the health care bill would only save us in the neighborhood of $5 billion a year. That $5 billion is nothing to sneeze at, but I think the savings would be much greater than that. Many more tests and procedures are ordered than needed to bolster the defense in case of a lawsuit. My wife and I were at a public forum in Virginia during the fall before the health care law was voted on, and one of the speakers was Dr. Howard Dean, whose campaign for president some years ago famously ended with a wild scream. I do not agree with many of his political views, but he is an honest individual as far as politicians go. Someone asked him the question, why is tort reform not included in the health care bill? It's really quite simple, he replied. The Trial Lawyers Association gives us, the Democratic Party, a great deal of money, and they don't want it in there. Many people in the audience were shocked at his candor. He only said what many of us knew was true, but very few in the Democratic Party were willing to admit it. As a neurosurgeon, which is one of the two most sued specialties, I have witnessed many lawsuits against doctors that destroyed careers, confidence, and families when the doctor had done nothing wrong. Unfortunately, in many such cases, a patient suffered an unfortunate outcome, even though everyone was trying extremely hard to solve the problem. In our country, there is no way to recoup lost income, lost potential, or other losses, including emotional distress, other than filing a lawsuit against the healthcare provider or the hospital. Most other countries have figured out a way to take care of injured individuals by providing some form of redress, but our great nation simply has no clue how to solve this problem. Obviously, that's not true. And like almost everything else in our nation, that doesn't make any sense politically. A special interest group is heavily involved behind the scenes. In this case, it's the Trial Lawyers Association. As long as we continue to empower and submit to the influence of special interest groups, nothing we do will ever make sense or benefit the general populace. By dealing with the problems I've discussed in this chapter, we can reduce the cost of our health care insurance to the point that most individuals and families could afford to own their own policies. This would provide portability between healthcare providers, limiting exclusions for pre-existing conditions, and the potential to further reduce healthcare premiums for those with healthy lifestyles. For instance, if people own their own policy, a premium reduction could be offered for anyone having an annual physical examination. We would detect many medical problems during the early stages of development, when treatment is much easier and less expensive. Also, if the patient owns his or her own healthcare policy, the doctor would not likely order excessive testing without being questioned about it, since doing so could impact the patient's premiums. A fiduciary relationship would develop between the doctor and patient since there is no detached third party receiving the bills, and that, of course, would result in tremendous savings. In other words, your doctor's responsibility would shift from what is required by the insurance company to what is medically and financially good for you, the patient. Also, if people own their own healthcare policies, they would not have to relinquish them when they turn 65, which might alleviate some of the pressure on Medicare. These are only a few of many ideas to solve our healthcare crisis. As we continue to try to improve healthcare access and quality for everyone, we might do well to ask ourselves the question, if the Golden Gate Bridge fell down, who will we get to rebuild it? Structural engineers or people who like to talk about building bridges? In like fashion, we would be wise to put healthcare reform in the hands of the people who know the most about healthcare, those providing the care and those receiving it. Chapter 11, A Nation Divided. Growing up in Boston and Detroit, I had political views that largely reflected those of the adults around me. Family, friends, and neighbors generally felt that they had been oppressed and that the responsibility for redressing these injustices rested with the government or with others. By the time I reached high school, the civil rights movement was in full swing, and the Democratic Party was positioning itself as the champion of civil rights. Like most young black people, I accepted the label of Democrat and endeavored to be a part of that struggle. After President Kennedy was assassinated and Lyndon B. Johnson took over, a host of social programs were unleashed, aimed at helping oppressed minorities and people like us living in poverty. I was particularly thrilled with Johnson's War on Poverty, which I thought would significantly improve our family's lifestyle. Even though my mother worked very hard cleaning other people's houses, we still benefited from government commodities such as cheese and flour. We also received food stamps and bus tokens. Even though she was not a welfare mom, My mother still very much appreciated the government assistance we did receive from time to time. Still, I had an inherent dislike for government assistance and was frankly quite embarrassed that we had to accept anything from them. By the time I entered college at Yale University, I was running away from poverty and didn't want to discuss that part of my life with anyone. But neither did I identify with the wealth on constant display at Yale. At that time in my life, I was proud to see groups such as the Black Panthers standing up to brutal police tactics, and though I never joined any radical student organizations, I kept abreast of the activities of the Students for the Democratic Society, SDS, the Weathermen, and other groups willing to use aggressive tactics to accomplish social justice. When George McGovern became the Democratic nominee to run for President of the United States, I voted for him enthusiastically, along with multitudes of young people, all of us, looking forward to a utopian world of peace and love. We envisioned it as a world without war, racism, or poverty. Plenty of hippies and flower children around me smoked pot, used illicit drugs, and engaged in free love as a part of that utopian dream. Because of my love of God and my religious upbringing, I didn't become involved in sex or drugs, but I still identified strongly with the anti-war protesters and the revolutionaries. I was quite unhappy when George McGovern was soundly defeated by Richard Nixon in 1972, and it looked as if life would go on as usual. I was a senior in college at the time and starting to think more about medical school than social justice. When I entered medical school the following fall, I immersed myself deeply in my studies and paid little attention to the political scene. The first year of medical school required a significant lifestyle adjustment in order to master so much material. There was not a lot of compassion for students who fell behind, and I saw many of my friends' hopes and dreams shattered by the merciless monster of academia. As I struggled early on, my academic advisor strongly suggested that I forget about medical school and pursue another area of study. Fortunately, I ignored his advice and redoubled my efforts to succeed. It meant getting up at 6 a.m. and studying constantly until 11 p.m. 6 days a week, only taking off the Sabbath in order to recharge my batteries. That intensive effort not only salvaged my academic career, but allowed me to flourish and begin to earn top grades and respect from teachers and students alike. Although I was still a Jimmy Carter Democrat, I was starting to sympathize with people who advocated for personal responsibility and self-reliance, since those were the traits largely responsible for my success in medical school. By the time I began training as a neurosurgical resident at Johns Hopkins, I began paying attention to politics again and was particularly intrigued by the optimistic speeches of Jimmy Carter versus the no-nonsense, very practical, although sometimes harsh, speeches of Ronald Reagan. Although Reagan's logical approach to many of our social and international problems appealed to me, he was a Republican. Because of my bias in favor of the Democratic Party, I figured Reagan must, by definition, be greedy, selfish, and callous toward the poor. As I got to know more Republicans and conservatives, however, I came to realize that many of my political beliefs were based on nothing other than propaganda, and that there was just as many decent Republicans as there were decent Democrats. I found that it was the Republicans who were responsible for the abolition of slavery and for the passage of the Civil Rights Act. I also began to realize that it was not political biases that were largely responsible for the plight of African Americans in our nation, but racist attitudes. After the many gains realized through the Civil Rights Movement, racist people from both parties adopted a paternalistic attitude toward African Americans and enacted federal and state programs designed to take care of people who couldn't take care of themselves. People who were ignorant, stupid, or just plain lazy. In the process of being do-gooders, both Republicans and Democrats removed much of the drive and determination from innumerable African Americans, who found it easier to accept government charity than continue on a path of hard work and self-reliance. Once people learned that their irresponsible behavior, such as having babies that they cannot care for, results in larger paychecks from the government, those lifestyle choices have negative implications for the entire nation for generations to come. Any attempt to withdraw government charity is seen as a heartless attack upon the most vulnerable members of our society. Most of the national media had aligned themselves with those involved in the civil rights struggle, which was the right thing to do. Unfortunately, most of the media also failed to recognize the long-term harm caused by those with good intentions who were robbing poor families of the incentive to obtain the American dream through their own efforts. This kind of smothering political compassion that skewed the mindset of large segments of our nation's populace after the gains of the civil rights movement reminds me of the problems facing Yellowstone National Park in the 1950s. Many tourists, full of good intentions, were eager to feed the bears, who were very cute in their antics to encourage visitors to hand over food. The bears quickly lost their fear of people, and instead of hunting for their traditional prey, they began invading camps and breaking into cars and campers looking for food. The forest rangers quickly realized they had a major problem on their hands, one that endangered the tourists' lives. The park enacted rules forbidding feeding of the bears, which exacerbated the situation acutely for a while. But, through brilliant management, the bear population relearned how to fend for themselves and began to stay away from the people. I am not equating people to animals, of course, but rather simply making the point that it is quite easy to become accustomed to an easier way of life, and after a while, to believe that one has a right to that easier way of life. As I witnessed this happening decades ago throughout our nation, however, I came to believe that we were robbing people of their dignity and their desire to support themselves. Even though I ultimately voted for Jimmy Carter both in 1976 and 1980, my political views were gradually shifting, and by 1984, those views were much more consistent with Ronald Reagan's and those of the Republican Party. I was particularly disenchanted with the extreme partisanship of the Democratic Party at the time, which drove me even further toward the right. Then, when the Monica Lewinsky scandal broke in 1997, I witnessed the extreme partisan politics coming from the Republican Party, which I equally detested. It was quite clear to me that both parties needed to re-examine their values, or lack thereof. Over the years, I found that no political party really represented my views of fairness, decency, and adherence to the principles set forth by the United States Constitution in 1787. So I became a registered independent, and have remained so until this day. I hope and pray that someday politicians on both sides of the aisle will learn to work together and not see each other as mortal enemies. Working toward compromise to solutions for the common good of the people is the only way that our leaders will be able to solve the enormous problems faced by our nation. The lives of some close friends of ours were destroyed due to lack of compromise. The husband felt that he had a special gift of singing and used a great deal of the family's resources to pay for voice lessons. The wife was in the healthcare profession and worked overtime to take care of the family needs, and she strongly disagreed with the way her husband was squandering the money. In his opinion, however, he was investing in a wonderful future. They were unable to resolve their differences, and one night I was awakened by a phone call informing me that the husband, wife, and one of their children had been killed in an accident. The wife, very distraught, had been driving very fast and had plowed the car into the back of a tractor-trailer truck, killing everyone. This needless tragedy could have been avoided if all were in a better frame of mind, willing to have some reasonable give and take. In the same way, many of the problems facing our nation today could be resolved if only the two sides were able to reason together and compromise when necessary. Finger-pointing utility. When constructive compromise on the part of both political parties is supplanted with a winner-takes-all battle of wills, the wheels of U.S. progress seize up. And when our leaders refer to members of the opposite party as enemies one minute, and then proclaim how important it is to have civil discourse and cooperation the next minute, it is not hard to understand why people become hardened to anything a politician says these days. But perhaps skepticism toward our leadership suggests we are close to returning to the founders' original intent of limited government and more local, individual responsibility. As a result, politicians would become less important to our country's direction, government would become smaller, and people would step back into the role of taking charge of their own lives. It may seem like a pipe dream, but I truly believe it is possible. We frequently hear it said that hatred among voters and politicians alike toward the opposite political party is worse today than it has ever been. But a careful reading of historical documents, including political commentaries and cartoons, shows that the differences between what were known as the Federalist Party and the Democratic Republican Party were every bit as intense, if not more so, in the days of Alexander Hamilton than what we see today. Some of those philosophical differences, in fact, eventually led to the fatal duel in which Hamilton was murdered by Burr. Because we now have 24-hour news cycles and cable channels, we have constant analysis of political bickering by mostly partisan correspondents and pundits. Even if the Democrats and Republicans were not enemies, many news agencies profit from the controversy by constantly stoking the flames of disagreements. Unfortunately, Democrats and Republicans today do appear to be mortal enemies, much to the detriment of our country. The vitriol hurled across the aisle from both parties is staggering. Yet, they both seem totally incapable of looking in the mirror and recognizing their own hypocrisy. When the party becomes more important than principle, we are in dire straits, for it reveals that our leaders are incapable or unwilling to think critically for themselves. No two people should think exactly alike on all issues, even if they are members of the same party, because people have different experiences that have shaped their lives and their perspectives. The beauty of diversity. I recently attended a rather elegant dinner party in Washington, D.C., and had an opportunity to speak at length with Republican Senator Scott Brown of Massachusetts. I told him how much I admired the fact that over the past several months he had been the object of scorn by both Democrats and Republicans because his votes are based on his principles and beliefs rather than on the party line. If everyone in the United States Senate voted that way, I believe we would all be shocked by how rational and reasonable the bills would be coming out of the congressional chambers. Unfortunately, the polarity we see in Democratic and Republican stands on issues suggests that many of our representatives have become puppets of their political party. All voters would be wise to look at their representatives' voting records to see if they agree with their views or whether they are always consistent with the party view. If your views and their views coincide the vast majority of the time, and the areas where they do not coincide are not deal breakers, then this is likely someone who represents you well. If, on the other hand, you find major disagreements with your point of view, you should do the responsible thing, which is to vote for the person who represents your views, regardless of party affiliation. If we all made a concerted effort to do this, I believe we would be delighted with Congress and their actions, instead of having a congressional body with an approval rating of less than 20%. The strength and unity of our nation was severely threatened by secessionists in the mid-1800s, those who wanted to form the Confederate States of America in the South to maintain the practice of slavery as a way of life. Rather than allow the nation to be split and substantially weakened, a great civil war was fought, which was extremely costly both in terms of lives and resources, but the nation was saved and the seeds of a superpower were sown. There are many who feel that our country is in as much danger of self-destruction today as we were prior to the Civil War because of the marked philosophical differences that divide us. During the Civil War, the issue at stake was slavery, whereas today the issue is personal responsibility versus governmental responsibility. Hopefully, we will not have to engage in a political civil war before we achieve the kind of unity that will again bring us strength and prosperity. There is perhaps more hope for our country than currently meets the eye. It would seem as if we are hopelessly gridlocked by Democrats and Republicans, each with very different ideas of government and its role in our lives. The ray of hope is found in the fact that there is an ever-increasing number of independent voters who sometimes vote one way and other times vote another way, and therefore cannot be taken for granted by either party. There is also the rise of the Tea Party, which is interested in limited government according to the United States Constitution. Capitalism with free enterprise, tax reform, sovereignty of the states consistent with the Constitution, border control, and fiscal responsibility. The very fact that so many people are joining the Tea Party or becoming politically independent suggests that people are less willing to be spoon-fed by a largely biased media and are thinking for themselves again. I believe the new Tea Party is going to be very important in deciding the future direction of our country. By its very nature, it is unlikely to ever become a well-organized political party, and it represents different things to different people. But the one factor that brings all of its constituents together is the desire for individual freedom and less government in our lives. No basis for class warfare. Having had the opportunity to experience virtually every economic class in our society firsthand, I have found very little difference between people from the lower middle class all the way to the upper echelons of the upper class in terms of financial values and belief in a strong work ethic. Most of the rich in America do not expect special treatment, nor do they get it unless they pay handsomely for it. Our society is very egalitarian, with a kind of social mingling and camaraderie not found in other nations around the world. I mention these values because there is really no natural basis for class warfare here in America. After all, relatively few people begrudge the wealthy of the things they have acquired honestly. Honestly is, of course, the key word there, for I also know few people of any socioeconomic status who are not outraged that so many Wall Street fat cats experienced personal financial windfalls during the financial meltdown of many financial institutions in 2008 and 2009. There continues to be an element, primarily in the Democratic Party, however, who use such abuses of the capitalist system to constantly evoke class warfare. They know that if they can get poor people to believe that they are the ones advocating for them, and that the other party advocates only for the rich, then it is very likely that the poor will vote for them in overwhelming numbers. And of course, there are a lot more poor people than there are rich people. By attempting to associate Americans who are well off due to their extremely hard work and honest efforts with those despicable, greedy financiers, they distort reality. For these are by no means the same kinds of people. And in fact, the hard-working, honest rich are the primary providers of jobs that allow us to have a middle class in this country. If we demonize, persecute, and overtax such people, they will become unsure of themselves and considerably less productive, which will have a devastating impact on the general economy, both because they are not spending and because they are not creating jobs. Class warfare is an artificial division created for political advantage, and it should be rejected outright by the American people, for we have far too many real problems to devote energy to artificial ones. Do unions truly unite or divide? Another growing division in our nation exists between people who are unionized and those who are not. The concept of unions is actually quite good, and they played a very important role in the industrial development of our nation. The initial idea was strength through unity to keep unscrupulous owners and employers from taking advantage of defenseless workers. Without them, it is unlikely that we would have ever developed a robust middle class. As time has gone on, however, many employees who are already well-protected, such as government workers, have insisted on unionizing in order to strengthen their hands during collective bargaining. Initially, this was about getting the highest possible salaries. But now, collective bargaining includes tenure, vacations, class size for teachers, meals, and a host of other things that frequently are not available to the general public. In many cases, unions have now evolved to gain unfair political advantage based on the numbers of potential votes that can be delivered and the amount of money that can be donated to political causes. Leaders of many of these unions see nothing wrong with coercing members to donate a portion of their salary for dues, which they use to create very large monetary war chests for political campaigns. They then elect politicians who are obligated to them, allowing them to further enhance their positions financially, socially, and politically. In a twist of history from unions' original intention, sometimes the unions become the bullies against whom other people need protection. I do not believe that the average union worker grew up thinking that they should have unfair advantages over everyone else. But many union leaders try to create an entitlement mentality among their constituents. Once people get used to having certain advantages, they will fight vigorously to keep them. Again, it is time for us as a nation to step back and ask ourselves, who is really being treated unfairly? Unionized government workers? Or taxpayers who have to support unaffordable benefits? If we can just stop being selfish and think about liberty and justice for all, we will not tolerate rabble-rousers endeavoring to create a need and a well-paid position for themselves. Having said all of that, there are businesses and industries that do try to take advantage of individual workers, and unions are very effective in those situations. But this does not mean that everyone needs a union. If physicians were unionized, it is likely that they would bargain for higher pay and fewer hours. It is unlikely that they would accept the sometimes meager reimbursements from insurance companies, and they would demand significant tort reform. I can hear the union bosses saying that those are just the things that doctors should be complaining about, and that they are foolish to allow themselves to be abused by an unfair system. I fully agree that many aspects of the medical profession are less than optimal, but we have jobs that allow us to help people and save their lives. These jobs provide a great deal of fulfillment and satisfaction, and there is no need to squeeze every drop of blood out of the proverbial turnip. If physicians join together, however, and demand job perks for us as physicians, simply because we provide a unique, indispensable service, doesn't that make us blackmailers? I am only using physicians as the example here because I am a physician. But the point is that it is rarely necessary to divide ourselves into special interest groups to gain advantages, and that much more progress can and will be made when we place our emphasis on creating opportunities for everyone as opposed to creating unfair advantages for those with the power to do so. Progress in the race against racism. The election of Barack Obama as the first black president in 2008 was a momentous occasion and signaled the fact that race was no longer a barrier to election to the highest office in the land. However, people still disagree about whether or not the United States remains racially divided. Over the last two decades, I believe a great deal of progress has been made. During that time, many minorities have assumed important and very visible positions in our society and performed extremely well, eliminating anxiety on the part of the majority about their capabilities. Today, one would have to live a fairly sheltered life in a highly biased community to harbor the belief that someone is inferior simply because of the color of their skin. This does not mean that racism has disappeared completely from America, but it is gradually becoming a dinosaur in communities of educated people. I do know some who feel quite differently and think racism is alive and well. When I was a psychology major in college, one of the things I learned, which in retrospect is really only common sense, is that people tend to see what they are looking for. If you think someone likes you, you are likely to interpret their words and actions very differently than if you think they hate you. Prejudice is generally born out of ignorance and the propagation of myth. Fortunately, Hollywood and the media have eliminated a great deal of misinformation about different races and nationalities. In the national elections of 2012, we will have a wonderful opportunity to really see whether we have largely vanquished racism in America. Part of that final shift will require white America to set behind them the notion that most black candidates running for office share the same political left-wing leanings held by President Obama, and to embrace the process of scrutinizing candidates' positions rather than simply making assumptions about them. Doing so will help confirm that the evil of racism is losing its hold in this nation once defined by it. Do our religious beliefs divide? Unlike the division caused by racism, which seems to be shrinking, the division caused by religious differences seems to be intensifying, with the greatest conflict between Islam and Christianity. I was recently at a university-hosted dinner for a well-known expert on Islamic culture, and I asked him if it were possible for Islam and Christianity to peacefully coexist. It was clear that the question made him very uncomfortable, but he answered it honestly and said, "Unfortunately, it is not possible, because some Islamists believe that Christians and Jews are infidels who should either be converted or at the very least avoid it. It is very important to remember, however, that there are 1.4 billion Muslims in the world, and to paint them with a single philosophical brush is just as absurd as trying to characterize the diverse thinking of billions of Christians around the world. Perhaps the real problem with Islam is its radical faction, which has grown dramatically in recent years. Large groups of Muslim youths, growing up in poverty-stricken areas in the Middle East and Africa, without a great deal of exposure to other religions and cultures, become relatively easy pickings for radical Islamic terrorists. These terrorist factions extract portions of the Quran, which they distort and use to convince these energetic but misdirected young people to join the holy jihad and receive an everlasting reward. With more than 1 billion Muslims in the world, there are certainly enough radical Islamists among them to cause concern. It is the quickest expanding religion in the world, but by births, not by conversions. With a number of that magnitude and the intensity of their hatred, it is easy to see how this can be an enormous problem both now and in the future. At least knowing the numbers gives us some perspective on whether this problem can be ignored or deserves our full attention and efforts to address it. Christianity, Islam, and Judaism all sprang from the seed of Abraham, which might lead one to believe that the religions should have enough in common to peacefully coexist. And if you exclude the radical elements of each religion, harmony should be within reach since peace, love, and fairness are foundational pillars of each of the religions. Since the vast majority of each religion's constituents embrace the concept of peace, it is incumbent upon those members to control their radical elements. This means they have to confront the radical elements who advocate violence and often the very principles that constitute their belief system. This must be done both publicly and privately, and they have to use every means available to them to eliminate this cancer among them. If they are afraid or refuse to stand up to the radicals among them, they will share in the guilt for the worldwide Holocaust that will ensue. The only way in which religious division will not be highly destructive is if people embrace and live up to the precepts and principles of their respective religions. What then unites us? In conclusion, many other factors, such as sexism and ageism, threaten our unity as a nation. But perhaps the most important factor is not what divides us, but rather what unites us. Proverbs 29:18 says, "Where there is no vision, the people perish." One defining feature of an outstanding leader is the ability to bring divergent groups together and unite them in a common mission, with benefits for all. Unfortunately, it is becoming increasingly difficult to discern what the vision for America is. Do we really know who we are and what we stand for? Do we know what we believe in? Or are we constantly walking around with our fingertips in the air, trying to decide which way the wind is blowing at any given moment? Are we willing to think for ourselves, or do we believe media pundits have all the answers? Our founding fathers placed so much emphasis on nurturing a well-educated populace because they knew that our system of democracy could not long survive with ignorant and uncaring citizens who could easily be manipulated by slick politicians. As we enter the next election season, I hope we will each be willing to take a step back and ask the question, what is of crucial importance to me and to the future of our nation? Chapter 12, Liberty and Justice for All. Growing up changes one's definition of what is fun. Maturation does that, thankfully. So I hate to admit now that as a boy, I thoroughly enjoyed throwing rocks at cars. It was a thrill to wait in hiding, ambush the car driving by, and then make our escape. Occasionally, a driver would stop their vehicle and get out to yell at us. But if we were really fortunate, they would chase us. We would run just far enough ahead to encourage them, but when they got close, we would turn on the afterburners of youth, leaving them far behind while we laughed hysterically. Once in a while, the police would come by, usually in unmarked cars, and the chase would be much more dramatic until we reached the 10-foot-tall fences at the end of the neighborhood field. To the police, it must have appeared as if they had us trapped. They had no idea, however, how practiced we were at vaulting those fences. We treated it like an Olympic event, running at full speed toward the fence, then leaping high into the air, grabbing the chain links, and allowing the momentum of our feet to swing us up over the top and down on the other side. We would laugh at the police as we ran off, knowing there was no way they would follow us. Today I have great admiration for the police, who risk their lives on a daily basis to protect our lives, freedom, and property. Remove all police protection in our society for just a day, and imagine the mayhem that would ensue. Sure, corruption exists in some police departments, because police officers are human beings like the rest of us. Give power to human beings, and corruption naturally follows. But police provide far greater good than bad in our society. Our justice system may have plenty of opportunities to malfunction, but we should not give up on it and must continually, objectively evaluate potential improvements. When I started reading as a boy and began getting serious about my future, I was deeply encouraged by stories of those who had gone from rags to riches. One of the things virtually all of them had in common was that they benefited from the freedom and justice in our system of government. I believe that all of these people would tell you that the only thing they really ever asked for was a fair chance to work hard, prove their worth, and benefit personally from their own efforts. When we stand, place our hand over our heart, and before our country's flag, pledge, with liberty and justice for all, we are simply saying that we want a nation that allows everyone to pursue their dreams as long as they are not injuring someone else, and that we will protect their right to do so. We should never underestimate the huge role that our justice system carries out in creating fair play, allowing individuals to be successful in a large and complex society where, given half a chance, bullies will take advantage of anyone. Our legal system is rather large and cumbersome, but in the long run, I would not trade it for any other system in the world. I was recently summoned to fulfill my civic duty as a petty juror. When I first received the notice, I began thinking of all the patient surgeries and clinical appointments I would have to cancel in order to serve. But then I remembered that an obligation is an obligation no matter who you are and what you have to do. If some of us think we are too important to fulfill our civic duties, the very strength that our wonderful judicial system is built on in drawing from a diverse pool of jurors breaks down. I will confess that I was in the courthouse from 8:30 a.m. until a little after 6 p.m., essentially wasting my time. I was being considered as a juror for two cases, both of which were medical malpractice cases, and I knew there was no way on earth the plaintiff's attorney in either case would accept a neurosurgeon as a juror. I'm sure the judges knew that also. Nevertheless, we spent several hours going through the motions, and eventually, jurors were selected. Do I think there are more efficient ways to select jurors? Of course I do. But I also realize that there will always be imperfections and room for improvement. And as long as we continue to work toward those improvements without being overly critical, we will make progress on improving a system that is already one of the best in the world. My first time in court, and one of the only times, I was a neurosurgical resident at Johns Hopkins. I had been driving my car on a newly opened stretch of highway, going 50 miles per hour, when I was pulled over by a policeman. "Sir, did you know that you were exceeding the speed limit by 15 miles per hour?" he asked. I was still surprised and confused about why I had been pulled over. "Well," I replied, "I was only going 35. The speed limit is 55 miles per hour." "No, sir," he replied. "The limit here is 40 miles per hour." "Where is that posted?" I asked. "At the entrance to the highway, sir. He issued me a speeding violation and told me that I should go to court if I felt strongly about it. Ultimately, I did decide to go to court to plead my case. But when I arrived and was waiting for my turn to approach the bench, I began having second thoughts about the wisdom of being there, as I watched how stern the judge was with others. Finally, it was my turn, and I approached the bench. "What do you do for work?" asked the judge. "I am a neurosurgical resident at Johns Hopkins Hospital," I replied. He looked up. My answer brought a smile to his face. "Do you happen to know a neurosurgeon there by the name of Dr. John Chambers?" "Sure," I said. "I operate with Dr. Chambers all the time." "He's a good fishing buddy of mine," the judge said thoughtfully. He paused a moment. "Case dismissed," he said. "Next case." The poor police officer who had given me the ticket was astonished, and I exited the courtroom triumphantly. Although it may seem that the judge was unfairly biased in my favor, I'm sure he knew the facts of the case and also knew that I had a perfectly clean driving record. Nevertheless, this case does point out how arbitrary some decisions can be, and those decisions can have profound effects on people's lives. This is the reason the founders of our judicial system inserted a provision to recall or dismiss rogue judges. They realized that judges are also people who can be quite imperfect like the rest of us, or who can become corrupted or even demented. I do not wish to imply that our nation is the only nation with a solid judicial system. After I finished my neurosurgical residency at Johns Hopkins, Candy and I spent a year in Australia, as I mentioned earlier, where Murray, our oldest son, was born. One evening, we were driving down a hill and noticed a large number of cars at the bottom, some of which were police cars. We were soon stopped by a police officer on the street who stated that we were exceeding the speed limit. The police had set up a speed trap at the base of the hill, realizing that almost everyone would be speeding by the time they hit the bottom due to their momentum. They were using radar guns, which they were all too happy to show to the disgruntled entrapped travelers. I argued with the police, stating that they were engaging in entrapment. I told them that I was an American citizen and that we rarely did such things in America. They invited me to go to court and state my case, which I decided to do. The judge there must have been in a particularly bad mood because he was slamming everyone, most of whom had legal counsel. Alone in a foreign country, I was feeling very vulnerable, and I asked God to give me wisdom as I approached the bench. The judge had already heard about the circumstances of my case because some of the other victims of that evening had just argued in vain for mercy. I started my defense by talking about radar equipment and their use of Doppler waves to detect speed. I told him that the accuracy of such equipment could legitimately be called into question when it is used on an angle, which rapidly degrades the accuracy of the detected waves. He was fascinated as I explained in detail some basic principles of physics. At the end of my discourse, he said, "Case dismissed." Both the American judicial system and the Australian judicial system are based on the English system, which has long been recognized for its fairness. Integral to a fair justice system is the opportunity for the accused to present their case to an impartial judge or jury, with an opportunity to appeal the judgment. Because there are a limited number of courts and personnel, our judicial system can be somewhat cumbersome and time-consuming, but it generally works. How many lawyers does it take to... As a neurosurgeon, I have had many opportunities to participate in courtroom proceedings involving medical malpractice claims. Fortunately, all of these appearances so far have been as an expert witness, primarily for the defendants, but in a few egregious cases for the plaintiffs. Much of our time during these trials is spent trying to educate the jury about things most of them have very little knowledge about. Unfortunately, in many such cases, the outcome of the trial depends more on who establishes the best rapport with the jury and puts on the best dog and pony show rather than who has the facts on their side. I simply do not have time to be an expert witness anymore, but 2 decades ago, I served as one for a local neurosurgeon who had experienced a bad outcome with a spinal cord tumor. The defense attorneys warned me that the plaintiff had hired Dr. Harvey Waxman as their chief attorney, and that he was very tough on opposing expert witnesses. Not only was he trained as an attorney, but he had also trained as a neurosurgeon, and he was president of the American Board of Professional Liability Attorneys. I was familiar with his name because he had done some presentations at national meetings of neurosurgeons on how to avoid getting to know people like him in court. I must admit, he was quite an imposing figure, exuding an air of confidence. As an expert witness, I try to be very cooperative, accommodating, and pleasant to the opposing attorneys, while gradually moving them into a position where I can expose the folly of their argument before the jury. It turns out that Dr. Waxman used much the same approach initially with his witnesses. There I was, trying to lead him into a certain position which would allow me to spring the trap, and he was doing the exact same thing to me. We quickly recognized what each other was doing, and we were having a fabulous time with our chess match. After the case was over, we were talking in the hallway and discovered that we had many common interests, as well as children who were similar in age. That was the beginning of a long and close friendship and many interesting discussions about medical malpractice. One of the things I admire about Dr. Waxman and about my own personal attorney, Roger Bennett, is that they would never accept a case that was without merit, even if they thought it could be settled, resulting in a nice fee for themselves. If all plaintiff's attorneys behaved in that manner, our judicial system would be much less congested, our society would be much less litigious, and the court's time would be utilized more efficiently, preventing another level of waste. Unfortunately, we have an overabundance of lawyers, all of whom need to make a living, and so we can expect to have excessive litigation in our society for a long time to come. I hope at some point the legal establishment will reduce the problem and attempt to regulate the number of attorneys produced. If they do not, society at large will have to produce a solution. The English system does not have the same kind of problem with excessive litigation because they have a loser-pay arrangement. In that system, if you bring a lawsuit against someone and you lose, you have to pay all court costs and fees associated with the lawsuit on both sides. In our system, most medical malpractice lawsuits are engaged on a contingency basis, which means the plaintiff has no out-of-pocket expenses even if the case is lost. It's basically like playing the lottery. You have very little to lose, and you might become a millionaire if you instigate a medical malpractice lawsuit. Whether we add a loser-pay arrangement to our legal system or devise another solution, the plaintiffs should have some skin in the game. To be able to bring lawsuits against people with no risk to yourself is antithetical to a harmonious and fair society. Unjustly accusing someone is also liable, but by the time a countersuit against the initiator of the first lawsuit is complete, the damage has already been done to the medical practitioner, who has lost